Welcome to Thriveology Lab Podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Phil Dunwoody, that's me.
And Neil Lutterbach, that's me. Phil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Today's topic is living purposefully in alignment with your values. And we're going to divide this topic into two portions. Today, we're going to look at just what are we even talking about when we talk about values, talking about purpose, what even is it we're talking about? And then part two, we're going to look at some of the practical applications, the how-tos, the nuts and bolts of that. So where do we start?
Exactly. So as I was talking to some of my students about this yesterday, and I jokingly said this is the meaning of life episode. Because to some extent, right, purpose is this, what is a meaningful life to you and what does that look like? And you and I know from teaching this, one of the things we ask our students to do is to actually reflect on their values. Mm-hmm. And then clarify them explicitly, and then kind of make goal statements about their future selves and what they want to become, so that they think more, much more explicitly about that connection between what they really value, and what they do on a daily basis, so that they're purposefully headed in a direction that feels meaningful to them, and. Our students routinely say they have never done anything like that before. They've never been asked to reflect on their values and what a meaningful life actually looks like for them. And I find that somewhat astonishing, but then maybe not surprising.
Exactly. And we talked yesterday, and we'll talk today about some of the effects of modernity and how where we are now. But I think something that's really useful to my thinking that you and I enjoy doing is like thinking about what would this have been for sort of Paleolithic hunter-gatherers.
Yeah.
And as Paleolithic humans, principally looking at some survival things, they're hunting, they're gathering, they're getting food, they're getting shelter, they're protecting the tribe. Once all of those things are met, it makes sense that the next human question would be, why are we here?
Yes.
And then, we talked yesterday, how do we get from like monkeys to Mount Olympus? Like, how do you go from just that survival animal basis to thinking about, well, there are gods and forces in the universe that explain some of the forces causally that we might experience on the planet.
Yeah. Yeah. And so just briefly, right, from evolutionary psychologists and evolutionary philosophers and biologists will often talk about kind of what function does having this search for meaning and purpose serve. In other words, how is it evolutionarily advantageous to us? Which is admittedly a kind of a biological reductionistic view of something that can be quite a spiritual big picture thing. And I think we want to look at both of those.
Sure,
I don't mean to be
exclusionary
in either one, but to take that kind of reductionist psychological, biological perspective. As we talked about in the episode on kind of relationships and tribe and community, we are social animals that to be successful, literally to survive, we need to understand. I need to understand how you think. I need to know your intent, whether it's positive intent toward me, negative intent. I need to be able to read your emotions, your cues. In other words, I need to constantly be trying to figure out what you mean and what your purpose is toward me and others in the tribe, right? So in other words, we are hardwired, or evolution has kind of designed us to seek out meaning and purpose as a tool for social cohesion, because this is what allows a tribe to be effective. If we're all just autonomous doing our own thing and there's no sense of empathy, I really don't understand what you're doing or have an interest in it, we're not going to be able to coordinate. We're not going to be able to problem solve. Mm-hmm. We're not going to be effective as a social species. So that this kind of bias we have toward seeing causation and seeing meaning and purpose, we then, just because we're hardwired to look for it, we then start looking for it everywhere.
Right.
Not just in people, but maybe in plants and in other animals and in the weather. And that this is essentially how you go from focused on just other animals in your tribe to then seeing causation, you know, anthropomorphizing what's happening mm-hmm. around you to say, oh, well, we don't have enough rain or we have too much rain. The gods must be happy. The gods mm-hmm. must be sad. And what can I do to appease them in the same way I would want to appease someone in the tribe that there might be conflict with because it's bad for social harmony.
Yeah.
Right. So I think this is an interesting, again, admittedly biological reductionistic view of why we tend to look for meaning and purpose. That said, I don't think it is reducible to that. I think, it is one of the things that helps us see it. But I think where we feel it phenomenologically is often when there's some crisis in our life, mm-hmm. right? When something feels out of whack, and we often don't know what it is. We just know, we may know we're depressed. We may know we're anxious. Something doesn't feel right. Or someone dies in your life. You know, my sister died in the last year. I had a couple other friends die over the past couple of years, right? And that will often, I think, should have you reflect on not only why am I here, but what am I doing with this precious time that I have? Because I never really know how long it will last. And that forces us to look at, like, well, is there a disconnect between what I think is important to me and what I'm actually doing on a daily life? In my daily life. And that's part of what this is about.
Yeah. And I think you and I have talked about this in the past. And I think the pandemic for a lot of people was a major crisis point.
Yes.
That revealed a lot of that sort of disconnect we often feel. We'll talk about how those might have manifested. But how for you, Phil, what was that sort of pivot point for you, or what did you notice during the pandemic?
So, oh my gosh, you know, I think I was one of the, I feel like I put my head down and didn't even think, like, that the work exploded in terms of trying to move us as an institution online, and I just did the work, right? Like, I felt like I put all of that on hold to some extent, but then over time, I think what we saw nationally, right, this the quiet quitting, the great resignation, was all this, like, well, you have you're being exposed with reminders of death on a regular basis, and then asking, like, what am I doing with all my time? And so while I was kind of, I'll say, grinding, right, with, you know, in front of my computer nonstop with trying to, you know, survive this transition, because we're not an online institution, right? For those of you who don't know, we teach at Juniata College. It's a residential liberal arts college. Like everyone else, suddenly everything was online. Well, we're not set up for that. And then through that period of, I'll say, grinding, one of the things I noticed was the absence of relationships. Mm. And what I mean by that, I see people in the hallway at work. When I go to meetings, we have small talk before and after meetings. And those are the social bonds. That's actually what builds friendship and connection. And all of that went away. And what I was left with instead was meeting after meeting where only the business happened, right? And all the kind of the social networking, the renewal that is so important to our kind of mental spiritual health, that disappeared. And I found that hard. Mm-hmm. And I did also start to wonder, you know, once I got through that, I did start to think about the number of hours I was working in my life. I was doing more administrative roles. And is that really what I wanted for myself? Part of what I went into academia and even a smaller liberal arts college was because I wanted what I saw for me as a better quality of life. I wanted to preserve more time for contemplation, more time for leisure during the summer and other times. But instead, I found myself in the dark wood of error, right? In that I was instead constantly responding to email, constantly in meetings, working into the evenings and every weekend. And, you know, at one point, I don't think I was even conscious of it so much until my wife said something to me about, like, you know, you're working all the time now. And I was kind of like, I am. And that would be okay if I felt fulfilled and satisfied. But instead, I was starting to feel burnout.
And empty, yeah.
All right. So how about you?
Yeah, for me, going into it, I would have said that I had a very clear purpose. I had it like in my bones. You could say, why are you here, Neil? I could have rattled it off verbatim. We'll talk about verbatim of what, Neil, but later. But like I knew it, and I would have otherwise said I was happy with it. Or thought I was. But oddly enough, during the pandemic, when all of the things were limited, when the availability, I wasn't missing the things I thought I would have been missing. And instead, I was missing some other things that I would have thought were less important to me. And, you know, so I began just really interrogating that for myself and like, why was that the case? And, you know, I think the other thing that happens, and we're going to talk about this a lot more too, like that sense of ought to and supposed to.
Yeah.
That, and I think that some of what I had crafted in that sort of pre-purpose was kind of rooted in a sense of, I'm supposed to do this or I ought to do this.
Yeah.
It wasn't really being driven by things I valued. Maybe that there was something even maybe performatively valuable about them, that I wanted other people to recognize these things are valuable to me. And
culture told you it was a good thing.
Right.
Yes.
And instead, when I really started getting, when again, as you pointed out, that sense of whether it was actual death or just that something is may not be again.
Yeah.
I began to really highlight certain things and discard other things. So
concretely, what were some of the things you thought you would miss that you didn't, and vice versa?
So I got really into Spartan races, and I love Spartan races, and they're so much fun. They're just like an adult playground. And I was, you know, super into fitness, and I still am. But there was something about it that, and I was framing myself. I was beginning to frame myself as a sort of a competitive athlete, and I was beginning to do well enough in the Spartan races, sort of at an amateur level, that I thought if I really took this seriously, I might be able to make something of this, even peripherally, just. You know, I was seeing some successes, and so I was starting to really dig into that and build that as an identity, as a marker. But like, and I had surfing and just sort of other well-being practices like mindfulness that certainly were part of my sort of that other sort of competitive side of things, but they were like at the bottom, like they were the afterthought. And now I've sort of flipped it. So like the well-being stuff, the surfing, the time in nature, and like really, obviously Spartans are very much in nature, but it's a very different experience from say surfing. So I would say that just sort of flipped for me. And I'm still sort of working through why and how I got there.
It sounds like you de-emphasize the competition part.
Yeah, right.
And more, I'm doing this because I enjoy it.
Enjoyment,
and
yep.
It's good for me.
Yep.
Not to put words in your mouth, but that's...
No, right.
Is that right?
I think so. I think that, like, you know, I think that goes to that cultural thing.
Yeah.
The joy and the pleasure and the fun of life, often it's like, well, you should be working. You should be doing something serious. Surfing is not serious, right? Unless you're a competitive surfer. So, like, just doing the Spartan races for fun, or just doing fitness because I enjoy it, suddenly wasn't sufficient for me. I had to be competitive. I had to show that I was making advancements in this.
Well, and this is. I think how culture influences kind of our daily activities because we get rewarded by our culture for some activities, and that is, we find that reinforcing. Again, we are social animals, and so we're very sensitive to signs of approval. right? From our in-groups. Mm-hmm. And so when we get those rewards, which it sounds like you are getting the sense of achievement, that increases the likelihood that you're going to do those things in the future. You're like, oh, okay, I'm good at this. I'm being recognized for this. That becomes rewarding. And so you want to do more of it. And I would say actually similarly in that my administrative experience, I was doing some stuff. I was being told I was good at it. I was giving more responsibility. And I was going further and further down that path that while it was being rewarded culturally, may or may not have actually been kind of true with my inner self. Mm-hmm. I don't think you always know that, though, until you're there, right? This is, again, back to the lab part, Thrivology Lab, right? You try things out. You find out what works, what doesn't work. You reevaluate.
Well, and that reminds me of something I was thinking about after our talk yesterday, and like something I always bring up to students. Like even tomorrow, I have Saturday, I have a exploratory session for students who are looking for colleges, and some of them don't know what they want to do. And even for young people, the idea of an exploratory pursuit in college is very looked down on, even though it's incredibly rewarding. And there's a fantastic book by David Epstein called Range. And in it, he looks at people who specialize early or people who explore a lot early. And so he starts with two paradigms. He looks at Tiger Woods and Roger Federer. And if you know anything about either athletes, you know, Tiger Woods, as soon as he was old enough to hold a golf club, his father was like, golf, golf, golf all day long, every day. And so people thought, well, that's the way to success. You specialize early, you specialize hard, and you go at it. That's all you do. And then Federer, his mother was a tennis coach who refused to coach him. So he sort of dabbled around in all these sports until he finally found his way to tennis and was able to apply that knowledge cross sport to innovations in his performance in tennis. And so what Epstein does is looks at across discipline, sports, military, business, education, the arts, music, you name it. It says of the most successful people in the world, were they specialists or did they diversify? And across the board, people who dabble, what he calls sampling, do better in the long run. Here's a quote from his book, Range. Eventual elites typically devote less time early on to deliberate practice in the activity in which they will eventually become experts. Instead, they undergo what researchers call a sampling period. And so even as, like, for me, and I think for you too, we've talked about being tinkerers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's both and, like, having a clear sense of and being able to articulate your values and your purpose points the ship in a particular direction.
Yeah.
But it's also okay to turn the ship.
Oh, like, my gosh, yeah.
When that direction no longer serves, go to a different island. That's okay.
Well, yes, absolutely. Right. So I'm reminded of when I first, when I was graduating with my PhD, I had a moment of doubt as to whether or not I wanted to continue in academia. That was my intention. I went through the 5 years of grad school. I was a little burnt out. I mean, it was a grind. There were parts of it I enjoyed. There were parts of it in terms of atmosphere. I'll just be blunt. I looked at a lot of my professors in an R1 competitive institution, and many of them did not seem like happy people. Mm. Right? They had essentially given up everything else, including their families, to be successful. And I was quite like, is that really the life I want? And so I remember talking with a fellow PhD student, and he asked kind of what I was doing after graduation. And I was actually going to work for my father-in-law, who's a civil engineer, and I was going to do land surveying. And I told him that. And I said, I'm just not sure yet if I want to continue with academia. I want to take some time to think about. And he said, that would scare the shit out of me.
Hmm.
And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, I've spent all this time. He's like, I can't question it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so I think there is a courage that is required to self-reflect and to say that the path I've been on and that I have invested a lot of time and energy into may not, maybe it was the right one when I picked it, but I'm not the same person, right? So it may or may not still be the right direction for me. You only know that through regular reflection. And this brings us to, I think, our discussion of what are your kind of core values and what is your purpose, and that people do get this sense of what Corey Keyes's term languishing, and in a way almost being stuck. Like, what am I doing here? Why am I here? Adam Grant talks about this, and that it's not. Sometimes it's not even this feeling of burnout and disengagement, right, is a lack of purpose, a lack of meaning.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah, there's a quote from Corey Keyes here: "Languishing feels like being on an airplane circling above the runway but unable to land. It doesn't feel like I'm in imminent danger. I'm strapped into my seat and generally fine, but there's a sense that I'm waiting for a resolution that's taking forever to come. Strangely, I'm not even sure what it is." Right. That, now, I think a lot of people, particularly during the pandemic, sort of felt that, like, I'm not, and I felt that in many ways too. Like, I'm not depressed, I'm not exhausted, I'm not burned out. I just don't feel quite as purposeful. I don't get out of bed quite as quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, our jobs involve a lot of mentorship, and you might say a lot of helping students try and figure out what their values are and their purpose. I mean, I view a lot of what we do as advising is helping clarify that. I'm not trying to turn students into me.
Right.
I'm trying to help them figure out what their path is, what's important to them. And I'm trying to help them differentiate that from what their parents have told them it ought
to
be.
Right.
And what society has told them. If those things mesh, then great. Mm-hmm. But if you go down the path, this is the difference between that ought to and what I really feel driven to deep inside. If you go down this path of, well, I ought to do this, and my parents think it's good, and society says it's good, you may find it very unrewarding, and that is okay.
Yeah.
You want to be able to reassess and say, well, all right, where does your passion lie? You're actually going to be most productive, most creative. You're going to make genuine contributions in the areas that you feel most passionate about. Mm-hmm. So you cannot ignore that.
And we're going to talk about, like, the difference between sort of finding your passion and forging your passion. But, like, I always tell students, like, it took me 10 years, 3 schools and 2 states to get through my undergrad. And in that time, I also did an internship with Disney. I joined the Army. I was wandering all over the place. And there was this pressure from parents who are very supportive otherwise, the culture says you're supposed to go to college, you're supposed to do XYZ, and I just didn't, it just wasn't right for me at that time. And had somebody just said, you know what, take the weekend and just journal and reflect on this, meditate on this, what do you really want? And if somebody said, like, it sounds like, because if I had taken the time to do that in those 10 years, I would have found that I just want to wander a little bit. I wasn't opposed to learning. I was opposed to school in a formal sense. But I loved going to museums. I loved reading. I loved learning new things. I just didn't like the formal structure of school at that time. And if someone had truly advised me, they would have said, pack your backpack and just go wander around for a year. But that's not something our culture supports. You know, it supports moving directly into the workforce. You've got to be productive. You're supposed to do these things.
Yeah. And this is, so you brought up a lot of things there, right? So one, I hear kind of this, that you need to actually be intentionally reflecting on your values to have a sense of what they are and where you should be headed. That if you're just kind of acting and all these forces about what you ought to do, do you have some practice, journaling, meditation, mindfulness, where you are deliberately thinking about what's important to you so that you can try and head in a direction that involves more of those things, right? So core values are supposed to be these things that that are guides for action in our lives, for behavior. If I think of, I will say some of the things I see in you, right? In that, you are very disciplined. I see that as a core value. You're incredibly creative, right? I've worked with you in a number of scenarios, and you're willing to kind of let's blow it up and imagine new things from the start. And I love that about you. And you also very much value kind of fitness and well-being and your health and whatnot. And so just some of the things I see. knowing that, I think, helps you make decisions about, well, what things should I say yes to? What things should I say no to? Because they may take me in a direction that helps me develop those, or they may take me in a direction that neglects those.
And I see in you, like, you love nature, you love being in nature, connecting with nature, your sense of justice and fairness and the standing up for and the courage to stand up for that, your curiosity, your learning, like, you're always asking those questions, hard questions, and that courage to have the difficult conversations. I see in you, and I see that in your teaching, I see that in your life. But, like, yeah, I think both and, right? Like, can you, and I think you asked this yesterday, like, what is the way in which you reflect on those internally? Yeah. And then what is the external reflection? Like, what would other people say about you? And maybe that's a trusted mentor, a trusted therapist, a trusted friend, like somebody who knows you and isn't afraid to tell you these things. And, you know, where are those overlaps and where are those disconnects as well?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's one I try and come back to myself regularly, is to ask what I think is important to me. What are my values? And then to ask myself, if someone else, and I forget where I first heard this, but if someone else was observing me, and let's just pick a time period, the last month of my life or the last 2 weeks, and they were to infer my values based on how I spent my time, what would they say? And I think that's a great exercise, because it makes you really think about, do the things I'm doing on a daily, weekly, monthly basis, do they actually reflect the things that I think are important to me? And I think they could be wrong in either direction. You said this about your experience with COVID. I thought these were important, but when they went away, I didn't miss them. Right. And so it's not to say that what you think are your values are always the right one, actually. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. It might be that what you're living is more true, but it might not be. And I think that's where the introspection, the reflection is really important for bringing life, your practice and your values into alignment.
And some of those, you know, one of the exercises we'll talk about on the next podcast is like a sort of a detailed worksheet that we take our students through as well. And it has a whole bunch of possible values on there. And they'll say things like, I value all of these things.
Yeah.
And then you've got to like pare those down, which is also to say that, you know, sometimes those values are still in you, but other ones come to the surface. So that for me was part of what happened in COVID. Other things sort of became more important. It's not that the other things weren't important. There might have been, and that goes also to that performative, like, how can we live our values and what would other people see, not in a performative way? So we're not trying to perform the values for other people, but we're just living them and having a trusted external person reflect on those for us. But
yeah, and then just to piggyback on that, right? So Schwartz is one of the big people in the kind of psychology researching values. And he defines them desirable trans-situational goals varying in importance that serve as guiding principles in people's lives. But to your point, and this is why I brought it up, in the abstract, we all say we approve of values.
Right.
But what the real test is when they are in conflict, which ones win out. And that's the only way you know about the hierarchy, right? So I went through graduate school. Two other people in my lab graduated roughly the same time as me. They both went directly into industry and started out making about double what I started at in academia. I knew I was trading some kind of extrinsic rewards, money in that case, for things that valued intrinsic to me. I felt called to be a teacher, and I valued more time to reflect. I wanted to live kind of that life of a scholar, if you will, right, where you have more time to read, you have more time to think, and you teach. That was a trade-off of two things. Like, don't get me wrong, I want the money.
Right.
I want the nice things that the money gets me, but it is a trade-off. And I have to decide which one wins out.
You pinged something for me that's, I think, really important. That idea of what I'm being called to.
Yeah.
That calling. And, you know, who is calling? Well, it's mm-hmm. essentially there's an inner voice saying this is important. But the thing about that inner voice is that we have to get it's a very tiny voice sometimes, and we have to get very quiet yes. and still to hear it. And that's where that reflection and journaling can be so important, because I hear this whisper in the wind. What is it trying to tell me? And life is really loud and noisy. It's all chaos and stimuli and all do, 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 go, go, go. And if we just listen to the external noise, it's very hard to hear that little voice inside.
I think it's an excellent point. You mentioned my love of nature. That honestly is part of why, because that is where I hear that inner voice most clearly. When I spend time in nature, and the more time, the better, the all those distractions start to drift away, yeah. and I feel more centered, I feel more peaceful, I feel like I have a better sense of who I am and what I actually value and what's important to me.
Yeah, right. And thinking about that from sort of this is from Greg McEwen's book, Essentialism, like, If I'm value all I sort of in the abstract value all these things, how can I reduce that to like the things that to that voice, to the things that are most essential to me? And so what he also talks about, both in a sort of practical sense and an internal sense, is that disciplined pursuit of less. And it reminds me mm-hmm. of the 20th century industrial designer Dieter Rams, who worked for Braun, the German company, who most people will know from the sort of electric razors and stuff. But he had a design philosophy that in German was weniger, aber besser, which is less but better. And so the idea was you don't do more, you do the simple things and you do it really well. And companies like Apple have taken that and adapted it in their own technologies as well. But I think about that from core values as well. Like, I don't need to do sort of divide my time and energy amongst 20 things. Mm-hmm. I want to divide that about fewer, five, say, and really devote my full attention and energy to them, such that I'm doing good for myself and for someone else and the world and some community, that I'm applying my skills and values and passions to someone's betterment.
Yeah. So the research on well-being shows that if you focus on extrinsic values, you are likely to be more successful on that. You are likely to make more money and whatnot, but you are going to be less happy. Mm-hmm. Less satisfied than focusing on intrinsic values. Right now, what I tell my students is that ideally we want to find a place where these cross, where the things you value, the things that are important to you that you really want to do, you can also make a living at, because it is nice to have heat and food. Mm-hmm. And it's not that money doesn't matter for well being. To be clear, it does actually. Poverty is very stressful, very hard on people. But if you focus just on the external rewards, you're going to feel like your life is more shallow. And, Viktor Frankl in Man's Search of Meaning, Man's Search for Meaning, really describes kind of he contrasts his approach with more traditional psychoanalytic approaches by, for example, Freud. And the more traditional psychoanalytic approaches really emphasize these basic human drives. They're kind of like we started this conversation, humans as animals. And what does that mean? It means we need sex and we need other things, these basic animalistic drives. And Frankl doesn't dismiss those things as unimportant, but he says that's not actually the big picture. The most important driver of human behavior is this search for meaning and purpose. And, he's a Holocaust survivor, right? So this book is just an incredible book to read because he does talk about some of the horrors of the concentration camps, but it's not a list of how horrible it is. Right. It's more about how he found meaning and purpose and how that allowed him to survive this horrible situation. I'm not going to say thrive, but how it allowed him to survive it. And that without that, he would not have. And he talks about this, that you saw. He's like, when people gave up the will to live, which was very easy to do, given how horrific the circumstances and even the probability of survival, you knew your odds were limited. It's like once you gave up hope, you were going to die within a few days. That just wasn't. And we actually see this in the literature, that having a sense of purpose, a sense of meaning, feeling like your life is meaningful, is related to lower rates of sickness and illness and longer life expectancy. Mm-hmm. You know, and we also see when, you know, sometimes when a spouse dies and mm-hmm. someone seems to almost give up, it's like their life has no purpose without their life partner, that, you know, that happens as well.
And we see that even some cases of retirement, when the thing yes. that had been driving someone's sense of purpose is no longer there, and they don't have something scaffolded in place post-career to give them that sense of purpose, suddenly the body seems to kind of let go and give up.
Well, if your only purpose is your work,
right,
and that comes to an end, you know, this is where I think a more fulfilling life should – your work, I think, should have a sense of purpose to it, but there should be other things, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I certainly, you know, as a dad, that's a big part of me. Certainly as a, you know, in a relationship with my spouse, that's a big part. You know, so there, it's not one purpose, I guess is right. the point, yeah. right? There can be many things in our lives that actually give us purpose, and that's probably healthier because to your point, when one of them goes, then you have other things you can kind of lean on.
Well, and to the Frankl example, like essentially those people, their career purposes, all those other purposes were stripped away. And so, you know, the people that were able to maintain hope zeroed mm-hmm. in on other family, other things they love. He recounts stories of holding sort of cabarets and talent shows within the camps, the prisoners holding those things, because they were fueling this horrific situation with a sense of hope that the Nazis were able to take some things from them. Mm-hmm. And they said, what you can't take is my will and my passions and my internal life and the things I find purposeful.
And can't take away your agency.
And my agency,
and this is,
right.
you know, this is something I do also talk very directly with students about, and even, you know, my children, because I hear people say things like, well, I didn't have a choice. I have to do this. I have to do this because either, you know, my parents require it or someone else requires it or my teacher requires it. Like, no, you have a choice. Mm-hmm. What you're saying is that there are consequences that come with those choices. Well, yes.
It's different. Yeah, right.
Right? Yeah. But you have agency, and that, and Frankl talks about that very much as well. It's like, yes, they put us in just this horrific environment that you had to preserve some of that sense of purpose and agency to survive it, right? This sense that, okay, you can take a lot away from me, but you can't take everything. I think some of what happens is that we go through a lot of life doing what we think we're supposed to be doing, mm. right? What we've been enculturated, what we've been taught. This is what it means to be a good person. And we get sometimes to a midlife point. It can happen at other points, but I think the typical midlife crisis is this sense of, I've been doing all these things that I was supposed to do, and I'm recognizing maybe my mortality, right? That I'm at this midlife, literally, point, maybe even less. And is this all? What am I doing with the time that I have left? I think that's a very healthy. I think we want to actually have that reflection much earlier
and more often. Yeah,
and more often. Yeah, yeah. And not to say that we want to switch from right. being focused on culture to being selfish. That's not what I mean, because right. I think actually when we think about what is most important to us as individuals, it is actually often our relationships with other people. Right. So it's when a loved one dies, for example, that we think, well, why didn't we get together more? Right. Why didn't we spend more time doing things together?
Well, and often the immediate recipe, if you're feeling like just depressed and lethargic and unmotivated and unpurposeful, the best recipe is go help someone else.
Yeah. Yeah.
Go work at a shelter. Go do work for someone else. To fix some of that.
And this is one of the the paradoxes of happiness, I think, is that you don't find happiness by looking for happiness.
Right, right.
Right? You find happiness by doing other things that result in happiness. And one of, and the research shows one of the biggest ones is actually helping other people, right? So it, you're not helping other people to be happy.
Right. A byproduct, yeah.
But that is actually the byproduct. I think one of the questions we wrestle with is how to find your way, and this difference between kind of culture and what it tells you is the path versus yourself. And so I read Martha Beck's book, The Way of Integrity, Finding Your Way to Your True Self. This is published in 2021. This has made me think a lot about my own life and my own value and purpose and how I'm spending my time. And I'm not going to go through the whole analogy. Martha Beck does a fabulous job of really discussing this through the lens of Dante's Divine Comedy, and talks about being lost in the dark wood of error. And that is basically coming to some point in your life where, kind of like we just talked about with the midlife crisis, okay, I'm here. How did I get here? What am I doing here? Is this really where I want to be? I don't think it is, because I feel anxious, unhappy, whatever it is, right? And she describes this, and you hear other philosophers and psychologists describe this as really this tension between doing what we've been enculturated to do. You know, a good person, they go to school and they get their degree and they get a job and they get a family and they do all the responsible things. Not that that's bad, but the things you've chosen along that route may or may not resonate with you at a deep level. So there's this inner truth, this, we were just talking about this, this inner voice, right? And it may be so long since you've listened to that inner voice that you can't hear it anymore. And that's why you're lost in the dark wood of error. And so that there is this, I think, this necessary reflection of, why am I doing the things I'm doing? What are my actual values? Right? Am I living in a way that is in alignment with them? And Martha Beck talks a lot about this. This requires incredible courage. She describes her life of growing up in a very strict Mormon family, getting married, becoming a professor, doing all the things she's supposed to do, and then starting to question all of it, and eventually leaving the church, realizing that she's gay, leaving her marriage. But it was this moment. It had become a crisis for her of physical health. We've talked about the mind-body as not being separate things, and she absolutely talks about, if you are living out of integrity, and what she means is out of wholeness, then you're living a fractured life, and you're going to have health consequences, physical and mental, emotional, spiritual.
Well, and the analog to Dante is very telling. I mean, what is Dante's Divine Comedy about? Essentially, hell, like,
yeah.
He starts midway in our life's journey. I found myself in a dark wood, the right road lost. That is a hell to live if you don't know why you're on a road, what road you're supposed to be on, and how many of us are living in that dark wood.
Yeah. So maybe this is a good place to break for part one of this. I don't know what episode we're on now. 9, 10? Somewhere in there. And then in the next one, we are going to talk about some approaches to finding your values. There are some psychology approaches to it. There are also some more kind of introspective, reflective approaches. I think I would say doing all of them is good. And then we'll talk a little bit about habits, right? How do you create, right? So if you find, as you and I were planning this podcast, it was kind of like a chicken and egg question, right, of what should come first, because you can't figure out how to move into alignment with your values and goals until you actually have a sense of what they are.
Right.
And
right.
That can be really challenging, I think. That first part is not taken lightly.
Yeah. Well, and so much of that about that habit, so much of what gets us out of alignment is habits that are out of alignment. Some of the behaviors that we do day in, day out that aren't supporting the true self here. Maybe a challenge for this week to get you ready for next week is to do some journaling, do some reflection on your values. If you had to make a list of the things and keep it to see what happens if you only could, if you only had five, you had five magic tokens, you could only give the token to five things. What would those things be? What is that inner voice telling you?
Yeah. And I think you could go about this two different ways, and I would encourage both. The one is essentially what you just described in terms of that inner voice, right? And if you were to just articulate them. And then the other one being to look at your own life and notice what you have actually been spending, what you voluntarily spend a lot of time on.
And money. Time and money.
And money, right? Yep. And what does that tell you about what some of your values are? And it's okay if you do or do not like some of those things, right? Yep. These do not all need to be positive things.
Right.
You may find that you value materialism more than you realized, for example, or whatnot. But yeah, engage in that reflection. So that's it for this episode. Subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube and we'll be sure to respond. And be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook. If you have questions or comments, there's a subject you'd like to hear us discuss, please reach out to ThriveologyLab@gmail.com. Thrive on.
Thrive on, friends.